I am here today with Jerry O'Neill in Columbia Falls, Montana. Well, the financial world, as we know, could come to an end at any moment because it's built on essentially nothing. And I guess that's what we're really going to talk about today. Jerry, you sent me some questions earlier in the week about a constitutional amendment or two that you're proposing this year in the Montana legislature, or next year, I guess, in the Montana legislature. How is all that going?
Well, I've got the bills in, one constitutional amendment to try to straighten out the Commerce Clause. Just to, rather than say Congress shall have the whatever the power to regulate interstate commerce amongst the states, it's the bill is to say Congress shall have the right to regulate interstate commerce between the states, and the object is to say they don't have the right to regulate intrastate commerce like Justice Scalia decided they do in Gonzales versus Raich.
So that's basically you're changing two words out of Article 1, Section 8, am I right?
That's right.
And do you have, I guess my question was, do you have any reason to think that those are the words that got us into trouble?
I don't think words got us into trouble. I think political philosophy got us into trouble. I think that the United States Supreme Court in the 1930s, whatever year it was, probably 1934, decided that they were going to give Franklin Delano Roosevelt all the power he wanted to push his socialistic agenda. What? And so they ruled his way. And if they did, either had a choice to do that, or they were going to, he was going to pack the court, and he'd get his way anyhow.
I think the court packing episode was in 37 or something. In 34, still had a fairly good court that was striking down a lot of New Deal legislation, but upholding some of it. I mean, there had already been about 20 or 30 years of fairly deferential jurisprudence at that point, right? I mean, they started upholding so-called progressive legislation really when? Back in the Teddy Roosevelt, William Howard Taft time, right?
Well, I think it probably started sooner than that with your civil rights. I think it's a lot of the problem started with Lincoln when he put the railroads through and had the federal government finance the railroads.
Obviously, that is the origin of a big corporation in America, isn't it?
Well, it's also the origin of one of the first big bubbles when he had to put all those farmers on the western wheat fields or western prairies and had them growing wheat, and everybody grew wheat, and pretty soon the price of wheat bottomed out.
I just found this out recently. Did you know that Lincoln was actually the one who invented the Department of Agriculture? Abraham Lincoln, not Charles Lincoln.
Well, it doesn't. It wasn't Charles Lincoln.
It wasn't Charles Lincoln, no.
There's another famous Lincoln.
It was a sub-cabinet department during his administration, and it was really amazing because that was the very first time that the federal government had ever considered doing anything so intrusive into the daily life of people who never left their home state, probably never left their home county. And so that was a huge change. And nobody who tells the story of the Lincoln administration ever mentions anything like that, which, you know, how do you possibly relate that to slavery or secession or anything else? It had nothing to do with any of the big issues that he's associated with, and yet, in an amazing way, it changed everyone's life I mean, it's where we get the agricultural fairs and the government-sponsored agricultural schools, 4-H programs, everything like that ultimately derives from this 1862 innovation, when you'd think he had other things to think about, that Lincoln made in creating a Department of Agriculture. I mean, if it hadn't been for the slavery issue, imagine how that proposal alone would have infuriated the South. You know, the idea that the biggest industry in one over one third of the country, probably one over one half of the country at that time, could be directly regulated by the federal government.
Well, I don't think Lincoln has any positive history about states' rights. Some people say he was this rail splitter from a backcountry cabin or something, but I see him more as this link of this lawyer who was the head lawyer for the railroads and had his own Pullman car to ride around the country and his beck and call. And he wasn't this small town lawyer. He was this big company corporate attorney. And that's the way he acted. And he had no problem with feeding his supporters lots of government largesse by giving them the money to build railroads across the country with all the graft involved in it. Up in Montana, we had James Hill build our railroad, and it was far left graft in it. And I don't think that the federal government gave much money to the Great Northern Railroad at that time.
You know, I don't know why he's saying that the Great Northern Railroad didn't get federal aid, because what they got wasn't it 100 miles on either side of the railroad line as a land grant, or was it 50 miles? I mean, it was at least 100 miles wide, right?
I don't believe so. I believe it was every other section on both sides of the railroad line.
Every other section? I've seen the maps that are a solid green line that looks very thick on either side of the railroad. Maybe that's just a conventionalization, but anyway, even if it's just one section, every other section on either side of the railroad line, that is got to be a bigger welfare grant has ever been granted to any individual. It's the origin of the very concept of welfare, really. You know,
corporate welfare.
Economic stimulus in the United States. And it seems like that just overwhelms the concept of, you know, capitalism, to have the government handing out huge, huge pieces of land to a small private interest group. And so this small private interest group, in essence, becomes part of the government. I don't see any other way to think about it. And I guess what fascinates me about that whole thing is that you were describing the Indian reservations, and we were talking about online the other day the relationship between the extremely rich interests, the extremely powerful money interests, and communism. And I guess it just really amazes me to think that without the government, there could never have been robber barons. Would you agree with that?
I have read articles about two different kinds of industrialists at that time, the industrialists that were supported by the government and the industrialists that made their own profit. And that article said that the ones supported by the government were the robber barons and the other ones were not.
So what's an example of a late 19th century non-robber baron industrialist?
During Grover Cleveland's time, I believe that one of the big guys that helped build out the country And I thought Cleveland appreciated his help, but I'm not enough on my up on my history to really know. Standard Oil, before they got tied up with the government, they reduced the price of kerosene from about $1 a gallon down to about 10 cents a gallon. And I think they did that without the government's help. And I think that's one of the reasons they got so much business, and that made some of my liberal friends think that they're robber barons.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, of course, I don't know anything about the price of kerosene in the late 19th century, but could that have been a monopolistic move to drive out the competition, or were they really able to achieve that much in by the way of economy of scale?
They achieved a lot by economy of scale. I'm sure that one of the reasons you put economy of scale in and reduce your prices is to get more market share. But
oh, of course, but you know, in antitrust law, there's predatory pricing, there's fair pricing, and you know, it has to do with the cost. The question I'm trying to get at with Jerry right now I don't think there was any need for antitrust legislation before 1860. No one perceived the need for to break up big corporations, because before 1860 there simply were no gigantic corporations, because the government hadn't funded any. The government hadn't given gigantic. I mean, and Jerry's absolutely right that the railroads, especially the transcontinental railroads, the Great Northern, the Great Western, and the Southern Pacific, those corporations could not have existed without governmental intervention and governmental subventions. So,
well, I don't agree with that. I mean, the Great Northern, it didn't have government assistance.
It had the land grants. It had the land grants.
I don't know. Maybe it did. It must have had the land grant. I know that in Flathead County, the county gave them some land, but.
Well, I really don't. I have not studied the Great Northern. You obviously have, because you're from Montana. But I know the Southern Pacific better than any of them. Huntington's Railroad, and you know, they still own land in California, Arizona, and New Mexico. It's amazing. They periodically try to sell some of it, and of course, a lot of it is in, you know, fairly unusable desert areas, but you know, they still have this amazing reservoir of I think today their reserve holdings are down to three times the size of Connecticut.
No, that's part of what Lincoln did, and I think robber barons probably have to have government help monopolistic laws passed in their favor, or government money given to them, or special tax preferences or whatever, in order to become to the point where they're dangerous to us.
So in other words, antitrust laws is the first example of the government creating a problem and then passing regulations to try to solve the problem they created.
Well, actually, the people, the corporations, or the people we call robber barons, they were in favor of this antitrust legislation because it set them up special.
Jerry, I guess I really didn't give Jerry a full introduction at the beginning. Jerry has been 8 years a Montana state senator from Columbia Falls and Kalispell, up by Glacier National Park in Montana, and he's now in his second term. He was Montana had passed a term limits act, and so now he's in his second term, just reelected in the Montana state legislature, and he's been pushing states' rights issues and anti-monopoly issues. Oddly enough, ever since he was elected, and I wanted to hear a little bit more about what prospect he thinks this Commerce Clause amendment might have, and if he's got any allies in it. And this is the first time you've actually proposed that amendment, right?
Yes, it is.
Now, are you still doing your 17th Amendment amendment also?
Well, I have that named something else this time. In Montana, the good citizens of Montana passed a citizens initiative. The selling point on it was to say corporations are not people. Well, this citizens initiative charged the legislature, which would include me, with taking away the corporation's voice in political process and in making that all political candidates would be equally funded. Well, I have a little bit of problem with both of those. One is when I think when you equally fund all political candidates, I think that's a communistic scheme. And two, when you take away the corporation's voice, I think that's an amendment to the First Amendment, a change to the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which says Congress shall make no laws infringing upon the right of speech.
Can these corporations exist without continuing? I think you were sort of leading in this direction. Can these corporations continue to exist without continuing governmental subventions? And what do we do with them if they can? And I think that the easy answer to that is if we abolished government subventions, and in particular, if we were to abolish centralized banking, centralized government co-opted banking. In other words, if we were to get rid of the Federal Reserve System, companies would, in fact, basically self-regulate to a much greater degree. In this way, they would obviously have to adjust their marketing strategy. Marketing is almost entirely controlled by credit. And the big TV, radio advertising that we see for major corporations, that is all a direct and proximate result of easy credit. And so basically, the Federal Reserve, in cooperation with the government, gets to decide who speaks the most. And I guess that this would solve Jerry's problem with the Citizens United issue also, in that if we had no easy credit, if we had corporations who basically had to compete with everybody else in the marketplace and look to the people, to basically small banks, non-centralized banks for credit, they would probably be cut down to size pretty rapidly. They would, if they wanted to do anything big, they'd have to be like everybody else. They'd have to pay cash for it.
Well, my bill is in order to cut down the corporate influence in the state politics, is to repeal the 17th Amendment.
And explains. I mean, I think it's a totally brilliant idea, but it's counterintuitive to a lot of people, I guess. So, would you explain to Robert and everybody else exactly how the 17th Amendment maximized corporate influence over the United States? Because I'll confess to you something, Jerry. This is something I learned from you. I had never thought about the issue until I met you.
You'd thought about the 17th Amendment a lot before you met me, or else you wouldn't
I
have
hadn't
driven all the way from Texas to Montana to help me try to get
what I hadn't thought
recruited.
about was I had not thought about until I met you and learned of your work. I had not realized the degree to which the 17th Amendment had maximized corporate power. And I'd like you to explain that.
Prior to the 17th Amendment, the state legislatures were in charge of appointing or electing the U.S. senators. And the state legislators, for a senator to come get the vote of the state legislatures, they had to appear in front of, well, Montana has 150 legislators. And so to campaign to 150 people is not that big a deal. In order to get reelected, I go to far more than 150 doors and talk to the people. And so they can do that with a very small budget. It helps if they have some history, so the legislators know what they stand for and what they're going to do about issues that are important to the state. Okay, but once the 17th Amendment was passed, took away, that made it so the U.S. Senator candidates campaigned to the citizens at large. In Montana, while it's a small state, it has 1 million citizens, which probably half of them are voters, so that's half a million people they have to appear before. In order to appear before half a million people, they have to buy newspaper ads and newspaper advertisement and news radio ads and whatever. This last election, we spent, it was spent on Montana Senate campaigns about $100 for every citizen of Montana. So we're talking about $100 million spent for the U.S. Senate candidates in Montana. And they get this money from corporate interests, from the bigs, from the big corporations, the big AIG, Bush, whatever the corporations are, Disneyland. It's and the big unions, big insurance companies, the big car companies, big pharmaceutical companies. As a consequence, that's probably one of the best buys they've ever, best investments they ever make. Like the movie companies, they invested in the race for Montana Senate and for the other senators around the United States. And as a consequence, the U.S. Senate extended the copyright period on copyrighted material, and that extended the copyright on Kipling's The Jungle Boy by 20 years or 50 years, which more than paid back for the campaign contributions for Disneyland or whoever owns the copyright for The Jungle Boy.
Jungle Book.
What?
Jungle Book, not The Jungle Boy.
Jungle Book, Jungle... whatever, The Jungle, Mowgli, and...
Mowgli was a jungle boy, but it was it's called The Jungle Book. Anyhow, sorry.
It was Kipling's work, and it got extended for many years, and now the industry, the movie industry, has made a big recoup on their money they spent getting their candidates or U.S. Senate elected. If you go into the pharmaceutical industry, the pharmaceutical industry has sponsored our U.S. Senate candidates, and they own, I think they own them, but anyhow, they wouldn't admit to that. But you try to get a generic or some cancer treatments to be accepted by the FDA, you just can't do it, because most of your FDA, your Federal Drug Administration people are former officers in the pharmaceutical industry, and vice versa. They go back and forth, and that's a pretty lucrative racket for them. And that's part because they own the U.S. Senate candidates, and the U.S. senators keep the FDA intact, and they pass laws against to require you to spend millions of dollars in order to put a drug on the market. And that's part of the reason you should repeal the 17th Amendment, so that these pharmaceuticals and the movie industry and the banking industry and the Federal Reserve Board and the whatever wouldn't have as much influence on our U.S. senators, and the U.S. senators would start speaking for states' rights rather than for the federal government's rights to be more intrusive upon the state's actions. I was shocked when McCain joined with Senator Feingold to pass the McCain-Feingold Campaign Reform Act, which said that corporations could not speak within 30 days of an election. And that was backing up some other stupid decision the U.S. Supreme Court had made when they approved that. And then this Citizens United was a group, a nonprofit group, which had some corporate money into it, and they were opposed to Hillary Clinton, and they put together a video probably a half an hour, an hour video they were going to put on pay-per-view TV and let it out for free so anybody could download it and look at, watch this video on why Hillary would be a bad candidate for president or vice president or whatever. And that is the essence of the First Amendment, the right of freedom of speech, is to let people speak and corporations and whoever speak on political items. And the First Amendment doesn't say that it's for citizens. It says the Congress shall make
no law.
I just happen to have a constitution here. Congress shall make no law respecting or prohibiting the free exercise or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Now, when I say, okay, we want freedom of speech and we want to repeal the 17th Amendment, the historians come up and say, well, Montana can't say that because Montana had W.A. Clark, who was a copper king in about 1900. And W.A. Clark, he bribed the U.S. legislators in order to become the U.S. senator. And he went to the U.S. Senate, and the U.S. Senate kicked him out because they knew he bribed the Montana Senate, Montana legislator. And so W.A. Clark gave the governor at that time free pass to Disneyland or wherever he got him out of the state of Montana. So the lieutenant governor was reigning then, and the lieutenant governor appointed W.A. Clark back to the U.S. Senate. As U.S. Clark went back there and served his time in the Senate. And as far as I've ever heard, W.A. Clark never set up the robber barons. He never gave government corporate welfare. He was a well-comported and, as far as I know, respected U.S. senator. The only thing of significance he did, he established a big library and gave it to the public. And so it was far better for us to have a millionaire, probably it'd be a billionaire under today's money terms, to have him back there where he had no obligation to support any other interest but him he spent so much money for the state legislators, he wanted to support them to say they wouldn't get mad at him and kick him out. So he didn't, as far as I know, he didn't do nothing contrary to states' rights. And he didn't put in federal welfare instead of states' welfare. But us legislators are pretty, we like to keep our rights to give out the welfare to the people. We don't want the federal government giving out the welfare to our Montana citizens. We want to give it out ourselves. And that is one of the reasons why you need to repeal the 17th Amendment, so the legislators of the various states give out their welfare rather than the federal government. When we give out welfare, we don't have a rubber checkbook. We have to pay as we go. And that right there would reduce the federal debt by a vast amount.
I don't know. Have you ever thought, Jerry? Jerry, you're affiliated with the Blackfeet tribe of Montana, right?
I'm still an attorney with them. Yes, or an advocate and counselor, I guess.
Have you ever thought of proposing to them that they try to organize their own bank?
They have a bank over there.
But is it in the part of the Federal Reserve system?
I think so, but I'm not positive.
Because I mean that is an aspect of tribal sovereignty that has not been curtailed, so every Indian tribe actually technically does have the right, as I understand it, to form their own banks, right?
As far as I know, I suppose they have a right to make them fractional banks too. Two banks in North Dakota that are of interest. One is a state bank in North Dakota, and the other is a Lakota Free Bank of North Dakota. And the state bank in North Dakota is where the state of North Dakota owns the bank, and they deposit their state funds in that and pay out of there rather than out of some other bank. The Dakota Free Bank, they have their deposits in gold and silver, or one or the other. And if you send money there, they put in the gold and silver, and your money appreciates accordingly, I believe. But I'm not sure enough to really guarantee that. That's about all I know about either one of them.
The interesting principle of Indian law in the United States is that Indian tribes were originally deemed to be independent nations, whether they really had an official state apparatus formed or not. And so under Title 25 of the United States Code and under the Constitution, the Indian tribes retain all sovereignty which Congress has not expressly divested them of. And of course, you know, Congress, by a mere majority vote, can deprive Indian tribes of any sovereignty they want. But they've left certain things untouched. That's one of the reasons why you have gambling and a sort of unregulated, various unregulated things on Indian reservations. If Congress has decided to leave little islands of selective freedom, and one area is, in fact, the banking area, that the Indian tribes have not been deprived of the right to set up their own banks. And I guess it's just interesting in terms of the Lakota Free Bank and what other tribes may want to do someday is try directly to compete with the Federal Reserve System by creating sound banks, since very few states are actually willing to do that. And I think that the reason they're unwilling to do that is because they basically all bought into this Social Security Trust Fund, which is an amazing thing, that basically the taxes that are collected for income tax and Social Security and everything else go into one big fund, and as long as the states play ball with the federal government, as Jerry says, they have the right to, they have a lot of money to spend. Do you want to explain a little bit more how that works, since you're firsthand involved, Jerry?
Well, all I know is the federal government is borrowing about 40% of the money they spend, and they send to every state more money than the states send to the federal government. So they're taking borrowing money to send to the states to compel the states to do what the federal government wants them to. And then Montana gets over 50% of our general fund dollars from the federal government. So we're kind of like a whore. We don't want to get rid of our best John. So we're pretty well compelled to keep servicing the federal government. We used to have a prudent unlimited or no speed limit on our highways. It was whatever. And the federal government said, hey, we're going to take away your highway funding if you don't put a speed limit on. So we put a speed limit on because we didn't want to lose the money. And the deaths on the highways went up, of course. So, but then anyhow, no, they own us. But the federal government, pretty soon, if they don't start paying their bills, they won't have any money to keep paying us so we'll keep servicing them. But,
now, this was a discovery I made just recently about Social Security. You say that the federal government is borrowing in order to pay its debts or to pay the states or just create this money. But are you aware, Jerry, what kind of securities they are investing in to borrow money for Social Security, and what kinds of securities they are forbidden to invest in?
Well, I thought they were best borrowing or banknotes or treasury notes. I thought, I'm not really sure that they're borrowing some money from China and they're borrowing some money from Social Security Trust Fund and borrowing money from whatever.
Oh, well, they are borrowing money from the Social Security Trust Fund, but do you know what the Social Security Trust Fund is funded with?
No, I don't.
This is one of the amazing things. As of August of 2011, the Social Security tax since 1937 had collected $14 trillion. Social Security taxes, $14 trillion. That's not even small change by the federal government standards. $14 trillion is a very significant amount of money. Of those $14 trillion collected in Social Security taxes, not one penny has ever been placed in the Social Security Trust Fund. As Judge Benjamin Cardozo put it in, I think, Stewart v. Halvering in 1938, the states can use this fund as a checking account. And yes, indeed, the law does provide that the Social Security Trust Fund in reality is not supported by tax funds. It is supported by non-marketable securities. And the only non-marketable security that I have ever invested in myself is a U.S. savings bond. Now, U.S. savings bonds are sort of the sine qua non of inflation. You buy them for $1 on every 10, and you wait a certain amount of time, and then you get paid back the full amount plus interest. It is a ridiculous kind of loan. It makes no economic sense at all. And, of course, U.S. savings bonds are not traded on any security market. You can buy them. They're marketable in that sense, but you can buy them and sell them. But they're insane. All they are is inflationary. They're the engine behind inflation. And U.S. savings bond, they sound so great when you're a kid, you know, you think you're getting something really wonderful. And then you realize this is what is totally destroying the United States is the creation of money out of thin air.